As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Coming up on this one, how far are Manchester United from Manchester City in terms of success on the football pitch? And what can they realistically do to close the gap next season? I'm Mark Chapman. This is the Athletic Football Podcast.
Against probably the best team in the world in this moment. And I think we are the only team in the world who is capable of fighting back against this team. We want to be there. And that is the next step we have to make.
With us today for this one, The Athletic's Mark Critchley and Laurie Whitwell. You were both at Wembley. You're both actually smiling. So that it wasn't all bad then, Mark.
Well, I cover both clubs, so I've got to stay professionally neutral.
Yeah, no, but you had to get down and back.
Well, no, I did. I did have to get down and back, and that involved half 4 start on Saturday morning, as well as a taxi back to my hometown in Chorley the night before. And then off to Leyland and a 7.5 coach journey down to Wembley, which was all the fun of the fair. I've got a new appreciation for the lads who actually choose to do this, even when there aren't train strikes on. But I've got to say, I really enjoyed it. They were very welcoming, the Leyland Reds. And it was a really enjoyable way of going down to the game.
Do you have to go down with Reds and back with Blues?
That would have been interesting. No, so just I just went on the way down. And then with all the post-match, all the coaches had basically left me at Wembley by then. So there was I had to scrimp around for a lift back up. But yeah, it was a different way of experiencing a game, like I said. But you know, and it's one thing that a lot of these fans would have done anyway. And I did speak to, you know, having travelled down with City, United fans, I did speak to City fans outside Wembley Way afterwards. And to be fair, despite all the disruption, despite all the chaos, despite everything that we've been talking about weeks and weeks up to this game, most fans seem to know about it in enough time to make their own arrangements and not have too much of a problem. So it wasn't too bad in the end, yeah.
I have to say, I went down and back in the day, and it all seemed, I mean, not in the interest of balance, just this was the way my sat-nav took me, but I went down the blue route and back the red route. Because I didn't leave Wembley till 7:30. So the red route was going to be a lot quieter come 7:30, I thought. But it was all perfectly fine, wasn't it, Laurie? I know there were a few arrests, but it was all...
I did the same as well, sort of as you. I drove down on the morning and then I actually stayed over at my friend's. I was supposed to give Mark a lift back, well, potentially, and then I let him loose with the Manchester Evening News boys,
because
I decided to stay down with my friend. And then, yeah, I drove back, you know, stopped off at Northampton on the way back on the services, and there was, you know, United shirts, City shirts still, that they were kind of making their way back gradually, and it all seemed fine. Yeah, for all the kind of expectation that this could be a 2011 repeat with the violence and the kind of anarchy, I suppose, it was pretty passed without much incident, it felt like to me. I don't know whether that's because the way the game went was sort of City keeping United at bay almost, and United trying to land a few punches but not really being able to. So perhaps people had come to terms with the result in a more kind of measured way. It was a perfectly good occasion for Wembley.
in the 60s and the 70s, the clubs and the players were very close, actually. And, you know, Mike Summerby and George Best were mates and all of that. And I did think, we talked about it at the end of the game, I did think with Ferguson and Summerby bringing the trophy out, and I thought before City went to get the cup, there was quite a lot of hugging and chatting between both sets of players. I mean, Fred went round all the City players. Bruno Fernandes and Bernardo Silva were involved in a big discussion. I think Eric Ten Hag gave Gundogan a big hug. I don't know whether he was trying to sign him or not, but gave Gundogan a big hug. It probably felt a little bit, and ardent United and City fans will probably hate me for this, but it did feel slightly friendlier than maybe I was expecting.
Well, you even had Pep Guardiola embracing Ferguson and getting the trophy, and you're thinking, Fergie of old, I mean, obviously he's been retired a fair few years now, but I don't think he'd been quite as satisfied or kind of okay with a manager replicating his treble. I mean, I asked Guardiola after the game, did he mention that at all? And he said, oh no, there was no time, and kind of laughed it off, obviously. But I agree with you, there's a kind of, I don't know, quite a lot of respect flowing sort of both ways, maybe more from United to City, because they're obviously, you know, Ten Hag particularly, he's worked with Guardiola, hasn't he, at Bayern Munich. That respect is clearly there, and an ambition to try and match what he's created at City, and he knows that, you know, to kind of make it all combative probably isn't the best solution, and kind of show magnanimity in the situation, I think, is the best way forward.
Yeah, no, I think there is a level of respect, and you've seen it, like you're talking about the groups of the Portuguese speakers and the Brazilian players there. They've built up their own little community in this part of the Northwest that stretches across even City, United, Liverpool even. And I think Laurie's mentioning about the game and the way it went, I think that maybe played a part, but I was out on Wembley Way before kickoff, and it was, you know, having been a veteran of that Euro 2020 final, I couldn't think of a scene that was any more different than that. There was a lot, you know, there really was just good-natured fans segregating. Once you go up Wembley Way, once you go up the steps, segregating in the different directions, you know, a bit of banter, a few chants, but really nothing like what I've heard happened in 2011. And the same at the service stations on the way down as well. They were segregated, like you mentioned, there was different routes for City and United, and you know, you can't strictly enforce that, because I was at a few service stations, still a few City fans milling around, but absolutely no problems whatsoever.
This episode is supported by season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX is Welcome to Wrexham. Premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Do you think, Laurie, you go first, that actually the game basically was a microcosm of United season under Ten Hag? All right. Decent in places, but with a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. It was basically a measure of where they're at right now, and I think maybe he will be satisfied that they actually gave a decent account of themselves. It wasn't a walkover. I think City did pull away in the second half. I mean, you also had the kind of chaos of the opening 12, 13 seconds, whatever the official time is gone down as. I mean, that was stunning, wasn't it? We were kind of just settling in to kind of start, kind of taking appreciation of what was going on the pitch, and already City are ahead, and you're thinking, wow, this could be huge. I mean, the first 5 minutes, I think United did look overwhelmed almost, and you know, for all the players kind of expressing calm with their hands, you know, towards the pitch to try and sort of tell themselves it was okay to go behind so early against City. But that would have just been the total opposite of what Ten Hag wanted, because he's very strong on scoring the first goal and being able to then build your way into a game. And against City, as I think Critch has said on a previous podcast that we've done, that you know, they kill the game, don't they, City, at that point. And actually, for United to respond in the way that they did, and I thought they caused City some issues, really. They were kind of well organised defensively and nicked the ball and were able to break quite well, quite smartly. It was just that final third they weren't really picking the crucial pass. And I don't know if that's personnel, I don't know if that's structure necessarily, but I think they actually, the plan was actually pretty good, and they did execute it fairly well. But it's just not having, you know, an elite striker at the top of the pitch. I think Rashford's better off the left. Sancho, I thought, actually did quite well in those moments, those kind of close exchanges where you're having to kind of thread a ball through a tight situation. But then I've also seen other people think, and this is probably justifiable, that does he really grab the game and force it in the way that you'd want a United winger to do, like perhaps Garnacho did in the second half when he came on. But yeah, I think you're right in terms of it being a kind of a symbol of United season, really, you know, some catastrophe. You know, if you think back to the 6-3 and 7-0 and 4-0, so with those two goals, they were both catastrophic goals really for United to concede. The organisation of them really poor, but then also some character and some hints that actually under Ten Hag they can build something.
The way that it starts is the worst possible way to start a game against City, not only because you concede, that sounds obvious, but because they will just shut a game down. They'll have safe spells of possession. They'll pass it around, and they won't let you get back in. And I know that I was surprised by how well United came back into the game after having that kind of smack in the mouth right at the start. Even up until the penalty, I just didn't feel that there was. Can you remember a real clear cut chance up until that point? And then to get that route back into the game and then squander it again with two really soft goals. That was, I think, from United's perspective, would be the frustration, was that you were given a route back in. City, I haven't watched them a lot this season. You know, they're a team that's capable. I remember being on this podcast the last time was after the Real Madrid game, the second leg at home. And they have those sustained waves of pressure that can just hit a team and break them. The reigning European champions. When that first goal goes in, that's what I was expecting. And I thought, you know, this could be a real nightmare from a United perspective. That didn't happen, and yet still, United didn't really take advantage of that and didn't really just come into the game in the way that I thought was still possible. And yeah, like, I agree. I think it showed a difference in levels that's been there all season. I know Ten Hag was coming out afterwards saying that this game, and we mentioned it as well on Saturday, this game was the difference between the total number of games that each side have won this season, so 41 versus 43, and this was the split. But I think that doesn't really give a true reflection, if we're honest, of exactly where these two teams are at.
No, and just on the football they played, Mark, I mean, until Garnacho came on, they weren't very crisp, were they? I mean, I understand the criticism of De Gea on his, well, the kicking stuff has been there for ages. I understand the criticism, particularly on the second goal. But United going forward, the number of passes that they overhit, bobbled in, chipped in, I mean, there was nothing like the crispness and the fluency of City at all during the game, and it only actually improved, and you could see some patterns when Garnacho came off.
Well, I think Garnacho's a player that has that impact, and this is maybe one of the biggest questions that was coming into the final, was about whether he'd start or not. We would asked to do our predicted 11s last week, and I picked him in mine, and he was the only difference from the one that started, but only because really I think there is this question now about how much of an effect can he have in the game from the start. I'm a big believer in Jadon Sancho. I always have been. I've been very patient with him personally, and I think he can still have a really big impact at United one day because he's got that ability. But it's been 2 years now, and it feels like if anybody came away from that game on Saturday is a bit of a fall guy, is a bit of a scapegoat for it, unfairly or not, it was him. And that's because he's just not this player that so far in a United shirt we've seen have that kind of impact on games that you're talking about with Garnacho now. I was thinking yesterday, he reminds me a lot, actually, Sancho, of Grealish at City last year, where he's a player who nobody's quite sure what he's doing in a game to affect it. That's turned around 180 for Grealish this season. Even though he's not really added the same goals and assists that people were looking for, people have a very different perception of what he is now. I think people are still trying to figure out, United fans especially, exactly what Sancho brings to the team. And if they had that sort of player, if they had Garnacho's impact through 90 minutes of the game, imagine just how much more dangerous United would be.
So as far as the future is concerned, I mean, we will talk players. We'll talk players who will be moved on. We'll talk players who will come in. We'll talk about Ten Hag as well. But there's going to be an uncertainty in this discussion, isn't there, Laurie? Because there's uncertainty within the club. And then, until they sort stuff out ownership-wise and boardroom-wise, the whole thing is just in the mire.
Yeah, there's lots of questions regarding that. And, I mean, what they say internally and what they're projecting to agents and players is that it's business as usual. So they are progressing with the mindset of, you know, the fact that they overspent last summer and they're having to be very tight with their budget this summer. Obviously, they could only do loans in January. So that's what they're progressing with. And that's the kind of basis of having conversations with targets and trying to assess the landscape. But yeah, at the base of it, you've then got, well, okay, what happens if then Sir Jim Ratcliffe takes over the club, or, you know, indeed Sheikh Jassim and the Qatari bid, although that's looking less likely just given everything that you hear. Does that change the dynamic greatly? I don't know. I think it seems like, I mean, Avram was there again, wasn't he? His third trip to Wembley this year for his expensive private jet flight, £250,000 a trip. I mean, he didn't answer any questions as he came through the mix zone afterwards. You know, he wouldn't do, I suppose. But I do think there needs to be clarity. There's a suggestion that there will be some clarity this week on that. But then you sort of check it out with people and they say, well, we heard this, you know, two months ago, the same kind of thing. So it's very... There's cloak and dagger, there's claim and counterclaim. But there's certainly people that... have, you know, that work with Sir Jim Ratcliffe that feel like they're putting the moves in place to, you know, ultimately take control of the club. But as until you get anything confirmed, even they don't know, you know, for sure. So it's yeah, this kind of guessing game a little bit. And in the midst of all that, as you say, they've got sales that they need to make, they've got signings that they need to make. Can they really push through on those things when there's this uncertainty over who actually, you know, signs the checks or gives the ultimate thumbs up? We're led to believe that at the moment, as it stands, if United want to make a signing, I know Avram was there, but it's Joel Glazer that's the kind of ultimate arbiter on that, and it hasn't yet reached the stage where bidders would be included in conversations about who they might be going for.
Budget-wise, is this, at the moment, with no takeover, is this more, the budget they have, is it more to do with financial fair play than it is... how much money the Glazers will give Ten Hag?
Yeah, I think so, because, I mean, in the last financial results, they said that they would pay off £200 million. It's a little bit more than that because of the interest, but of the revolving credit facility, you know, the company credit card, as I call it, which was what they used to make signings last summer. So if they pay that off because they've, you know, got revenues in, then theoretically they could spend, it's 300 million is the maximum they can spend on this revolving credit facility. So, you know, if they really wanted to, they could push the boat out, and obviously they could, you know, pay in installments or whatever. But yeah, I think it's the, you know, financial fair play, profit and sustainability rules that are limiting what they can spend this summer. And we've previously reported, you know, 100 million plus sales, but then you also speak to people that say, well, they kind of need to sell first. It's difficult to work out without seeing the full accounts exactly what United can do based on the rules. But there's certainly, that's a conscious sort of factor in many people's minds at the club.
And therefore, and this doesn't make it very sexy, Mark, because people want to know, are they going to sign this player? Are they going to sign that player? But actually, it means when you look at the list of players that they're being linked with, even if they buy two of them, I can't see how they can afford anybody else.
No, that is almost a symptom of the position that they were in this time last year. I think that's what you've got to go into this window conscious of, is that United spent upwards of £200 million outlay last year on transfers to get on with this rebuild that everybody said needed to be done. But that was, speaking to people at the time, that was much more than they ever expected to spend going into that window. They knew there would be a knock-on effect for windows after that. But it still wasn't enough to meet the scale of the task that needed to be done. And so you can look at names now, obviously. We've been reporting about Mason Mount. Laurie's mentioned Rasmus Højlund and Colin Mwani as well. These names are out there. It's going to be difficult to address those positions that need to be addressed, but address the other positions that need to be done as well. On top of that, if we're looking at a midfielder and a striker, we still haven't addressed the biggest elephant in the room, and the biggest elephant in the room on Saturday, which was the goalkeeping situation and David De Gea. So it's, again, like I say, a knock-on effect of this bigger, deeper, the breadth of the rebuild that needed to be done this time last year. I think we were all conscious of it then, that this club was nowhere near. I mean, people didn't really expect them to finish top four, did they? They have. No. And so they're in a strange position at the end of this season where it's a good season, it's full of progress, but there's so much work that needs to be done. And that's really, it's quite rare for a club of United's size and stature to end up in that, because you often think, it's just, you look at City and Liverpool over the last few years, it's only ever really been a few additions here and there. With United, the scale of the task is much greater, and the funds mean that it's going to be stretched over a number of years.
Which is why a lot of United fans, I think, will probably understand the move for Mason Mount. And they do probably need midfield reinforcements. But a midfielder might be third or fourth on the main list of priorities, wouldn't it?
I think there was a bit of surprise when Mount was the first name that's really been solidly, incredibly linked. It's part of the package, like I say, that of this much bigger, deeper rebuild that needs to happen. It's probably an element of it is that it's probably a slightly easier deal to do than some of the other names that have been banded, certainly some of the top priority names, if you think of Kane, for example. So that's maybe why it's come out first. Again, but take your pick. You know, we're looking at a squad here that has several different holes, and different people might prioritise different ones. I still think the chase for Frankie de Jong last summer was so protracted and so high profile and ultimately unsuccessful that Ten Hag's still going to be looking for a midfielder who he feels is able to take the ball under pressure, take the ball off the back four, carry it up the field. That's what he was looking for. Whether that's Mason Mount or not is a different question, but it's not that much of a surprise that he's still looking in that area, for me at least.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, when we came out of January, the two positions actually were, you know, clearly centre forward. That is absolutely, you know, just beyond anything you could. It's beyond scale in terms of how important that is really for United in the summer, and even to the point where, you know, Ten Hag ideally I think would like an experienced striker and a younger striker, so that they've got that kind of dynamic where, you know, you've got one that perhaps, you know, for future years would be a great, you know, asset for, you know, 5-6 years, but that isn't immediately under pressure to perform. So like a Højlund, so Atalanta is 20, you know, so that they would probably be a gamble if they went for that. But as Critch has touched on, it's a deal that is there to be done if the price is right. You know, Atalanta do sell their players. That's something that he's looked at. The player himself, I mean. Then Harry Kane is the one that Ten Hag, you know, sees as the ideal centre forward candidate. How could he not be? 30 goals this season for Spurs in a bad Spurs team. He's done it season after season. He's still actually playing a number of games. I think it's like 45 games on average he's played in the last 9 years, which is, so it's a good, you know, for all the kind of idea that he's getting on and he's somehow got injury problems, I don't really think that stands the test in the statistics. But then again, does Daniel Levy want to sell to a Premier League rival? You know, the idea is absolutely not. So do United really want to go and push that like they did with the Frenkie de Jong situation and have a long drawn out summer? Is a free transfer more likely next summer? So yeah, they're the kind of sort of questions. But I do think midfield, as Critch has touched on, is something that United do need to enhance, just because, I mean, they signed Eriksen and Casemiro last summer, who obviously, you know, raised the level that United were able to get to in terms of control. Eriksen, I think, has drifted probably in recent weeks, certainly physically. He's 31, Casemiro's 31. So you've got these two guys there over the age of 30 that, you know, are you starting central midfielders? I mean, Mason Mount's 24. He's won the Champions League already. He's, you know, been Chelsea's player this season twice. I can see that some people are looking at that thinking, it's not really a signing that excites me. But I think actually maybe that's what United have lacked in previous years, where you've had these kind of star names and, you know, let's go for the shiny thing. Well, actually, this is a potential player. If Ten Hag thinks that, and, you know, I think he first saw him play for Vitesse Arnhem against Ajax and Vitesse won. If Ten Hag thinks that, then you kind of, you know, you have to, I think, understand that he's seeing how the team would function totally in his mind.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
How many do they want out? How many could they actually get money for?
There's a few I think that they could get money for. I mean, Dean Henderson's probably the most obvious one, just because he's been on loan at Nottingham Forest. He wants to be a number one somewhere. So
he's not in the United goalkeeper conversation then anymore.
He could be, but I think it's already got to a point where Ten Hag ideally would like a goalkeeper that is brilliant with his feet. And he gave that first hint, didn't he, after the City game. He's been asked about De Gea so many times. Is he going to be a number one goalkeeper? Is he going to sign a new contract? And he's always said, no, we want him to stay. We trust in him. He's got the most clean sheets this season. This was the first time where he was asked about De Gea's kicking particularly. And he said, look, there's issues in games that we want to build on that aren't quite right. And that was the first kind of indication that, he ultimately does want to have a better goalkeeper in that department. And Henderson, for all his character and shot stopping, I don't know if he's actually that much more comfortable on the ball than De Gea. And Nottingham Forest are right there to say, for example, I think there's another club as well that has expressed an interest, maybe Tottenham, given Hugo Lloris is departing this summer. But that you could get 25, 30 million for him, I generally think that. And that would then, if you could funnel that into, say, that would be maybe half or, 4/5 of what Mason Mount might cost you. I don't know how that would shake down. So I think that's one. Scott McTominay is another one where Newcastle have expressed an interest. We saw Marco Silva have a conversation with him after the game where Fulham visited Old Trafford. And he's 29, 30, I think he might be 30 now actually, Fred. He's got 1 year left as well. So he maybe is the more obvious candidate to be sold. He won't get as much money maybe as McTominay, but you've got more years with McTominay at the club. So, I mean, Harry Maguire, that's the other big question. We sort of mentioned him in a piece this morning on The Athletic about transfers to watch. The indications that I get are that he wants to stay and that, it would probably be a difficult deal to do if United did want to sell him, but how satisfied will he be sitting on the bench if he is to do the same again next season? Victor Lindelof started the FA Cup final instead of him. So, and Gareth Southgate's mentioned, hasn't he, about his England position, being in jeopardy if he doesn't get more minutes. So, they're big. I wonder if, United have tried to sell better. James Garner, look at him last summer, where there was sort of a bit of disagreement, I suppose, from fans that wanted him to be given a chance. I mean, he's actually done okay, I think, last sort of month or so under Dyche at Everton. So maybe, time will tell on that exact deal, but I mean, at least I feel like at least in that one they did. Ten Hag had decided he wasn't going to make it in his team. They got good money for him, sort of 10 million or so. I know there's add-ons and things, but I think that was fine. So United are conscious of getting better at selling players because they need to, just for funds, but also for competitive tension in the squad, to kind of keep these players on their toes, really.
And then the final one is De Gea then. You may know, you may not know, I don't know. But what does your gut tell you that they're going to do? Mark, you go first.
My gut, I was asked this yesterday as well. I was asked, what do I think they'll do and what do I think they should do? And I think most people now, there's a building consensus that what they should do is say, thank you very much, but time's up. And that, I think that's the conclusion that you have to come to. Saturday was a microcosm in itself, in terms of, we mentioned the kick in there, but you look at Ortega's role in that first goal, picking out Haaland out on the right to expose a big duel on the right flank so that it comes back inside and they score after 13 seconds. When De Gea kicks those long balls upfield, he's just kicking it to get rid of it. That's the difference. United need a keeper that's able to distribute like that. So what I think he should do is that they should, say, thanks very much, but see you later. And have a bit more of the ruthlessness that we associate with United in the past that they perhaps haven't shown in the last decade or so. But what do I think will happen? If I was going to put a fiver on it, I'd say he probably stays at the minute. He spoke very confidently. He was giving interviews a few months ago about how he thought it would all end in agreement, essentially. There's not been those interviews as much anymore, but look, I think that tells you that from De Gea's side, it's all agreed. that it isn't quite over the line yet tells you that there's still a bit of a grey area there and things could still change. But if I was going to make a prediction, which I never really like doing, I would say that he probably does stay, yeah.
I think Mark's explained it perfectly there, really. The question mark I have is that it has felt like it's been agreed for a while, this, the contract. And why hasn't it been announced? Why hasn't it actually been confirmed? Because you'd have thought, like, maybe after, you know, he got announced as, you know, the Golden Glove winner for the season, that they go, okay, actually, and we've committed him, so next season, you know, I think there is that optics element of any kind of contract announcement. And so, yeah, it'd be interesting to see how long this goes on for now the season's finished before any conclusion is reached, or any announcement is made, just because, yeah, I think it's felt like it has been sorted for a while. And, you know, they basically, you know, Ten Hag thought, well, listen, if I've got a certain amount of money, I'm not going to go and spend it on the goalkeeper right now because he's sort of doing okay. I know there's some issues, but I can kind of deal with it. But I think maybe that mindset might, maybe that's changing, where he actually thinks, if I can get another goalkeeper this summer, if I sell this player and or maybe if I forego that player to bring in, this actually has become more of an important issue for me.
Laurie, Mark, thank you very much. That's it. You can subscribe to The Athletic for £1.99 a month for the first 12 months. Just go to theathletic.com/footballpod. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.